From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Bill Bradley is basically very, very close to Wall Street. His top 10 career patrons, his number one is Citigroup, which has given him $454,000 over his career. The thing about Gore that we found quite stunning is his closeness to Occidental Petroleum.
As Gore and Bradley face off in New Hampshire, we'll look at the selling of the presidency 2000. And 25 years after the end of the Vietnam War, as millions of Vietnamese continue to suffer from Agent Orange, we'll have a debate. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the race for the Republican presidential nomination heats up in New Hampshire over tax cuts and his chairmanship of the Senate Commerce Committee, Senator John McCain is challenging fellow candidates to reject attack politics and make the process noble again. At the same time, the Arizona senator and frequent critic of influence of money in politics says his new status as serious challenger to George Bush is raising all sorts of questions about his ethics. Indeed, McCain found himself on the defensive yesterday, the same day the Boston Globe reported he had prodded a federal agency by letter to rule on a license application submitted 2 years earlier by a campaign donor, Paxson Communications. McCain said he only pushed the FCC to act, not on which decision to make, which said is an inappropriate step for a congressional committee chair with oversight of what he says is an inefficient agency. We'll have more on that story later in the show. Labor Secretary Alexis Herman yesterday retreated from a policy interpretation that had explicitly stated employers were responsible for federal health and safety violations that occur in their employees' home offices. Business leaders and GOP lawmakers strongly protested the policy, which was articulated in an advisory letter to a company in Texas that suggested employers could be liable for such issues as unsafe stairs, improper lighting, and inadequate ventilation in home offices. Maryland lawmakers and children's advocates joined yesterday in criticizing a Montgomery County judge who said an 11-year-old girl was partly to blame for a 23-year-old man sexually molesting her because the girl invited him into her bedroom and, quote, "it takes two to tango." The delegate from Montgomery, Cheryl Kagan, called the Circuit Court Judge Dirk Thompson's comments an outrage and said the state legislature's Women's Caucus plans to look into his handling of the case. A nationwide coalition of religious and environmental organizations are unveiling a campaign today that's designed to steer oil giant ExxonMobil in the direction of corporate responsibility on global warming. 22 religious organizations have filed a resolution calling on the corporation to make a serious commitment to develop clean and efficient alternative energy sources. Peter Altman is national coordinator of the campaign ExxonMobil. Can you explain this new initiative?
Sure. Hi, Amy. The initiative is an ambitious effort by a total of 42 groups right now around the country who want to reverse ExxonMobil's stance on global warming. And the company has taken a position of denial, delay, and misinformation on this issue, which is something that really threatens all of us all around the world. Global warming is important because it threatens people's pocketbooks. It is an issue of social justice. And it's something that we all need to really care for the earth and stop companies that are ruthlessly exploiting it. And so these organizations around the country have teamed up to pressure Exxon and the board to solve the problem. People who want to get involved can call us at 1-877-SAVE-TIGER.
And that's 1-877-1 more time?
1-877-SAVE-TIGER.
Thanks for joining us, Peter Altman, national coordinator of the campaign ExxonMobil. And more news, officials at the National Archives, who are in charge of telling the rest of the government how to save and safeguard email, are red-faced about a mishap in the computers of their own high command. They say they lost at least 43,000 electronic messages last summer, wiped out without a useful trace. They were supposed to have a backup system that could replace the missing information, but said it wasn't working properly. This news from Miami. The cousin of Elian Gonzalez says the boy's family is afraid to tell him about the decision to send him back to Cuba. Meanwhile, the family's attorney says he plans to appeal the ruling by U.S. immigration officials. The INS has decided to send the six-year-old back to his father in Cuba. He's been caught in an international custody fight since Thanksgiving. And this news from Phnom Penh. The Cambodian government gave quick approval today to a plan to try surviving Khmer Rouge leaders for genocide, despite lingering UN concerns over limits on how much influence international jurists will have. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Al Gore and former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley traded barbs last night on health care, Russia, the meaning of presidential leadership, and gay issues in a prickly debate laced with sarcastic one-liners. The two candidates for the 2000 Democratic U.S. presidential nomination met in their fourth debate, the first of this year, at the University of New Hampshire, in the state that will hold the first primary of the campaign on February 1st. Although Gore enjoys a double-digit lead over Bradley in national polls, most surveys show the former New Jersey senator narrowly ahead in New Hampshire. Both Gore and Bradley said in the debate that if they were elected president, they would require their appointees to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to fully support allowing gays to serve openly in the military. Before we turn to some underlying issues that are perhaps the most important motivations for actual legislation and policy that gets passed and implemented in Washington, we thought we would bring you an excerpt of the debate. It was hosted by ABC's Peter Jennings, with some New Hampshire reporters asking questions in between. We'll begin with Al Gore.
We passed tough welfare reform, which I think has worked. You voted against it. I voted against those budget cuts. You voted for them. I voted, as I said a moment ago, for the resolution to use military force to push Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. You voted against it. My question is not about the details of those votes. It's really more basic. Would you vote differently on any of those three votes if you had it to do over again? Were they mistakes, and why?
The answer is no, I wouldn't have voted differently. In 81, if everybody in the Congress had voted as I had voted against the budget, for the budget cuts, but against the tax cuts, we would not have had the deficits of the 1990s. As a result of that, we would have had more economic growth. As you are well aware, given the economic growth now, when you have more economic growth, you have more revenue coming to the government, which would have meant more money to do things to try to help the people who are poor. No on welfare reform. I don't think the answer to the problems of people who are poor in America is to take a pot of money from federal officials and send it to state officials and say, spend 80% of this as best you can. I think that this is a much more serious question. We have a booming economy, welfare is down, but deep poverty is up. It's not down, deep poverty. I was out in L.A. not so long ago, in East L.A., and I did a session in healthcare, and a woman came up to me and said, what are you going to do about this welfare reform bill? I said, what do you mean? She said that the people who are going out to work are getting minimum wage jobs, they're not getting any training, and therefore they're never going to move forward. When I voted this way, I got a call. I was in later doing something for CBS, and I got a call from a mayor of a major city in the United States who said, Bill, unless something happens, if we get into a recession, I'm going to have 100,000 people on my streets. And I voted against the welfare reform bill, quite frankly, that is not the welfare reform bill today. Because I said at the time that you'd spend the next 4 years correcting that bill. But remember, this vote came in October of 1996. October of 1996, who knew if Bill Clinton was going to win? Maybe it would have been Bob Dole. If it had been Bob Dole, there had been a long time before there were any changes made in that welfare reform bill. So no, I wouldn't have voted because I don't think that you deal with this problem with kind of federal shirking of responsibility and states assuming all responsibility. I think there's a commitment there that has to be good. As you know, one of the changes that was made was to give the governors greater flexibility about the 2 or 5 year cutoff. But if you give them more flexibility, I guarantee you, I'm going to watch to see if they cut people off. I'm going to watch that very vigilantly as President of the United States. And on the issue of the Persian Gulf, no. The fact of the matter is, when the vote was taken, I thought that we should continue sanctions, as did most people in my party. And I thought that you should continue sanctions and then later have the right to use force. I said I was prepared to use force at a later day. And that's a decision that I made then, and I stand by it.
Well, I think all three were mistakes, but I'm not going to debate the details of it. I mean, I think that people were trapped in the old welfare system. I met earlier with Christine McGuire here, who lives in Portsmouth, has two children. She was trapped in welfare. Now she has a good job. There are millions like her. Saddam Hussein would still be in Kuwait if we had tried to rely on sanctions. Those budget cuts from Ronald Reagan hurt New Hampshire. And they, you know, but my point is beyond that, Bill. In all those words about the three different votes, one word I didn't hear and was the word mistake. And here's why I think that is important. I think our country deserves a president who, when he makes a mistake, is willing to acknowledge it and willing to learn from it. Because I believe that the presidency is not an academic exercise. It's not an extended seminar on theory. It has to be a daily fight for the best interests of the American people. The position of president is the only position filled by somebody who is charged with a responsibility for fighting for all of the people. If I make a mistake, I'll do my best to own up to it and then to learn from it and learn from you about how we can deal with the reality as we find it and then work together to shape that reality to make this a better country.
Can I ask you, Bill, how large a mistake is a president allowed to make? Mr. Bradley, Mr. Gore, either one of you.
How large a mistake is a president?
You both talked about mistakes.
Yeah,
you talked about admitting mistakes.
I'll pick three things that I didn't think was a mistake. Were mistakes. If you want me to admit to a mistake so that I can pass this litmus test, I'll admit to a mistake. I voted against Alan Greenspan the first time.
I'm not touching that one, sir.
That was a mistake. But you know, someone once asked Sam Walton, who was the head of Walmart, how do you be successful? He said, by making the right decisions. He said, how do you get the right decisions? He said, with experience. He said, how do you get experience? He says, making the wrong decisions. So well, I think you learn from your mistakes.
Let me respond to that. You know, in heading up the Reinventing Government program, which has made a pretty good start in trying to reform our government, I learned the old axiom that I didn't know before. If you're not making some mistakes, you're not trying hard enough. And I think that a president who tries to bring fundamental change to our country has to be willing to try new things. I supported the Welfare Reform Act, for example, because I thought that it was a bold plan that needed to be tried, and it has worked. But you know, the country can ill afford. The country can ill afford big mistakes by a president who stumbles into something that could be avoided with the kind of judgment and experience that our people ought to have the right to expect in any president. Now, it's up to the voters to decide how to find that in this race. I'm proud of the 7 years that I have served in shaping this economic policy, in reducing the welfare rolls, in helping the president bring about peace in various regions of the world, in reducing the crime rate for 7 years. But I am still learning, and I think that a president who tries to do the best job possible to take our country into the future and the way we should go into the future has to be willing to really get out there and push the boundaries and try new things.
I'd like to ask you both a question about a litmus test, if I may. Mr. Bradley used the phrase, and you both talked about gays in the military. You both believe that gays should have the right to serve openly in the military. President Clinton's had great difficulty. The Joint Chiefs, as well as the Congress, have been a principal obstacle to that particular policy. If you become president, I'll ask you one at a time, you first, Mr. Gore. If you become president, will you nominate members of the Joint Chiefs who only support your gay policy? In other words, will it be a litmus test?
I have rejected the notion of litmus tests on the Supreme Court by saying that there are ways to find out the kind of judgment somebody has without posing specific litmus tests. I think that it's a little different where the Joint Chiefs of Staff are concerned, because you're not interfering with an independent judicial decision. As Commander-in-Chief, a president is given orders, in effect, or he is he's the superior of the officers that are reporting to the Commander-in-Chief in the chain of command. I would try to bring about the kind of change in policy on the don't ask, don't tell policy that President Harry Truman brought about after World War II in integrating the military. And I think that would require those who wanted to serve on the position the Joint Chiefs to be in agreement with that policy. So, yes.
So, I understand it correctly. You would only nominate members of the Joint Chiefs if they supported your gay support.
I think that the new policy has to be implemented in a way that accomplishes the goal and yet recognizes the practical challenges that the military leadership will have to confront in making that change. I would insist, before appointing anybody to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that individual support my policy. And yes, I would make that a requirement.
Mr. Bradley, would you, sir?
I can say that in much shorter words, I think. And that is, when you're president, you are Commander-in-Chief. And you issue orders, and soldiers are good soldiers, and they follow your orders. A consultation process takes place, certainly in which you hear their view, but when you follow an order, no matter, I'm sure that there are people in the military today that don't agree with President Clinton on 50 things. But my sense is that when you're President of the United States, military people are loyal to their Commander-in-Chief, whatever the policy is that the Commander-in-Chief calls for the country, and that's what I expect him to do if I'm President of the United States and we move toward gays in the military, which I intend to do.
Now, based on your brevity, sir, you get that.
Bill Bradley, New Jersey Senator, Democratic presidential hopeful. Sparring with Vice President Al Gore. They faced off in New Hampshire last night. Just an excerpt of what they had to say. Both Al Gore and Bill Bradley saying last night if they were elected president, they would require their appointees to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to fully support allowing gay men and lesbians to serve openly in the military. When we return, we're going to speak with Charles Lewis, head of Center for Public Integrity, about the money behind these men. Tonight is the Republican candidate debate in New Hampshire. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
What will you do without freedom? Will you fight?
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And so the Democratic presidential candidates debated last night in New Hampshire. The Republicans will do it tonight. Many feel that there are a lot of big words, empty promises. What are the real records? And more importantly, what are the interests behind those records? Well, today, in the first of a two-part conversation, we turn to Charles Lewis. He is the founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. And he has just published a book, the group has, The Buying of the President 2000, which details the relationships between the candidates and their most generous contributors. We're going to take a look at the Democrats today, as well as the latest controversy over Senator McCain defending his FCC letter. He urged action on one of his major donors, Paxson Communications TV station purchase in Pittsburgh. And we're going to find out what Charles Lewis's response is to that. But welcome to Democracy Now!, Charles Lewis. Why don't we start out by you explaining what the report is all about, and we'll go to the Democratic candidates first.
Sure. The major findings, first of all, this was 24 people working for 18 months, pulling all kinds of tens of thousands of documents and interviews with hundreds of people. I mean, we found what most Americans deep down in their gut kind of understand, but in essence, we've documented it and laid it out, that all the leading presidential candidates in both parties in the year 2000 presidential election, all of them have done favors for special interests that support their candidacies. And in fact, there are long-standing relationships in many cases going back 20 years for some of these politicians that have been around that long. And so we, as you know, they never admit this in all the dialogue and discourse. They think that there's a problem and we need to address some of these issues, blah, 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 but they never will acknowledge that they are beholden themselves. And so what we're trying to do is pull all this together and show who they really are. I've been doing investigative reporting now for 20 or 25 years, and I've decided sometime long ago to listen to watch not what they say but what they do. And this is really a book about that. Anything you wanted to know about these candidates, who's really behind them, that's what The Buying of the President 2000 is all about. And so we have top 10 career patrons of all the major presidential candidates. And actually on our website, which is www.publicintegrity.org, we actually have the top 25 career patrons and lots of additional data. But So we have that, and we also looked at the two political parties. We wanted to see basically what exactly are the parties up to and who supports them. And we have the top 50 party patrons throughout the 90s, and that's really quite revealing. So anyway, it's that's what it's all about.
So let's start by going down the list. Why don't we begin in alphabetical order with the Democrats and look at who is supporting Bill Bradley in terms of the big bucks?
Well, Bill Bradley is basically very, very close to Wall Street. Top 10 career patrons, his number one is Citigroup, which has given him $454,000 over his career. But second is Merrill Lynch, third is Goldman Sachs, fourth is Chase Manhattan, fifth is Morgan Stanley. So the first five are Wall Street securities firms. And, you know, he was on the Finance Committee in the Senate. He is from New Jersey. That securities industry, a lot of folks in that industry live in New Jersey. But we, you know, it is interesting. I'm on a journey, not a campaign. Bill Bradley is a little bit misleading to the actual reality. Most people don't realize, or maybe they're starting to, that he was really quite close. There's almost, you know, it's hard to say who is closer to Wall Street, Bill Bradley or, I mean, all of them are quite attempting to get close to Wall Street in terms of the cash, but Bradley is as close as anyone, as far as I can tell. We also found that in the chapter on Bradley that he had introduced 45 bills for chemical companies to import chemicals into the U.S. that they could put into pesticides and rosins and dyes and things like that. But what's interesting is they wanted to avoid the import duties, and so they asked Bradley to introduce special bills on their behalf. Some of these chemicals are quite serious and dangerous. There's a whole class of them, organophosphates, that were actually invented during World War II by the Nazis for chemical warfare. Some of them have been banned, actually, these chemicals. Anyway, from an environmental standpoint and from a corporate welfare standpoint, it's a little bit embarrassing for Bradley for this to be known because, of course, he's now portraying himself as a crusader. So that's Bradley. I mean, I could keep going, but that's the essence of it.
I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post today that is looking at your book. Book alleges donors sway parties' policies. And there is a response from the Bradley campaign. And Christine, is it Ludeck? Kristen Ludeck says, anyone who knows Bill Bradley knows he's not beholden to his contributors. She cited as an example his recent proposal to close $125 billion in corporate income tax loopholes.
Right. I should say that article, and I said this yesterday at our press conference, I mean, all of these politicians and their spokespeople are all going to say, oh, they're shocked that anyone would suggest they're beholden. This book lays bare the lie that they're not beholden. And regarding his proposal, we're going to have something on our website today. People forget, he said his proudest achievement legislatively was the 1986 tax reform. We have precise things we're going to put up on the website today of exemptions that were granted to scores and scores of American companies by members of the Senate Finance Committee, including Bill Bradley, worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars over the last 10 to 13 years. And so, you know, it's great that he has an interesting proposal now, but this has not always been the Bill Bradley of the U.S. Senate. And I'm just trying to show what's really there, not what people are saying. It's always laudable for people to do proposals about corporate welfare, but, you know, some of the words of his spokesperson, frankly, ring a bit hollow.
Well, let's go on now to Al Gore. Al Gore, who's a biggest contributor, is Ernst & Young.
Yeah, Ernst & Young, the fourth largest accounting firm in the world, 660 offices in 130 countries. They've given him $125,000. They do a lot of tax lobbying in Washington. A lot of their tax clients have gotten in to see either Gore or people around him in the Clinton administration. The head of their Washington office, Jeffrey Hirschberg, is the managing partner, is one of Gore's leading fundraisers. He was actually his the Clinton-Gore finance chairman in 96, and he's now one of the honchos helping to raise the cash. Gore gets his money from basically now as a national politician on the national scene for 7 years. It's not surprising he gets money from all over the nation in different. He's been trying to tap everything from Silicon Valley and Hollywood to Wall Street in different sectors. First is Ernst & Young. Second is Bell South. Third is Goldman Sachs. Fourth is D.E. Shaw Company, which is a global securities and investment firm. And fifth is Citigroup. But the thing about Gore that we found quite stunning is his closeness to Occidental Petroleum. Now, this has been written about a little bit over the years. His father, who was a senator for years and years, was very close to Arm & Hammer personally, and when he left the Senate, was defeated in his last election, he went to work for Arm & Hammer for $500,000 a year, and Al Gore Jr. and Tipper flew on Arm & Hammer's corporate jet, and there was a close social relationship as well as a financial relationship because there was also a land deal that has brought in $300,000 to Al Gore Jr. Over the years, which we document in great detail, having gone through all the financial disclosure forms. Why is this important? Well, Occidental, you might remember the Teapot Dome scandal back in the 20s. There were two parcels of land owned by the Navy, Teapot Dome in Wyoming and Elk Hills in California. Well, the Clinton administration sold off the Elk Hills oil reserve to Occidental. And it was recommended, the sale was recommended by Al Gore in his Reinventing Government proposal in 1995. And so anyway, this is in one fell swoop, this is the largest privatization of federal land in U.S. history, and the oil reserves for Occidental literally tripled overnight. So we're trying to show these relationships. Now, for a guy who writes books like Earth in the Balance and is a staunch environmentalist, this is kind of a different visage for the public and for us. And we were surprised by it, and we don't understand it. And when you ask the Energy Department for information about the bidding process that went on with Occidental, they won't release the information. And there's a lot of very curious things. And I said yesterday at the press conference, I asked why won't I think Vice President Gore has got to explain this a little further. He clearly had some awareness about the parcel of land. The oil companies lusted after this land literally for decades. During the Nixon and Reagan and Bush years, they tried to get this land, and they couldn't. And the Congress frequently would block it. And this time, in the 90s, they've gotten it. They also got a 4 million acre reserve up in Alaska, which is a whole other story, but it involves the same administration. So that's the kind of stuff we found with Al Gore, and we also got into the his phrase about K Street to Kmart is frankly kaflooey as a phrase. I mean, it has no meaning. We show all the lobbyists and all the folks around Al Gore. I mean, he is in essence a creature of Washington. He is as much aligned with K Street as any politician really in the last 20 or 30 years. Bob Dole and others come to mind. Anyone who's in Washington that long becomes entrenched, with these interests. And one quick aside, George W. Bush and Al Gore have the highest amount of money from lawyers and lobbyists. These are the, sharp shooters who know precisely who's going to be elected next and are placing their bets, basically. And it's kind of interesting and revealing.
Chuck Lewis, why is it that you have these debates, you have reporters asking questions? They're mainly style questions, hardly any serious substance based on record or money or contributions, any real, solid facts that they're being challenged on. It's usually about their plans for the future. And, of course, any candidate can say anything they want. You were a reporter, and you left it. Why? I mean, isn't the best place to get your information out here? You're holding news conferences hoping reporters will cover them. You had this national platform at CBS and ABC.
Right. Well, I know that people have written books about this, and there's all kinds of theories. All I know is the kind of stuff we're doing at the Center for Public Integrity, you can't do in mainstream journalism today. there is not an interest for these kinds of stories. Now, we can say it's because of the media monopoly. You can say that the biggest special interest of all is the media, that they're lobbying on all kinds of issues for telecom and other things, and they have a vested interest in not discussing this, or certainly things like free airtime in the whole campaign finance reform debate. They certainly have a vested interest in that discussion. You can paint all kinds of scenarios. It could be as simple as the economics of it. They're really into content and the innocuous or titillating content is preferable to controversial content. There are a million theories why this happens. All I can tell you is that this is a little bit raw. Some of this stuff is a little too worrisome to them. As you know, a lot of these reporters need access to the campaigns. And the campaign knows that if something like this comes out, you deny it and hope it's a one-day story. And if you're TV and you don't have many pictures and the candidate won't talk to you, you're out of luck. So it's a combination of factors why these issues are not covered properly. That's not to say it's not terribly frustrating.
Well, maybe part of it has to do with the shared interests, but that brings us to the Republicans and the expose of sorts that I was watching on Nightline last night that's in the paper today as well, a furor around John McCain and the communications industry, a letter that he wrote to the FCC urging action on a donor's TV station purchase. Can you explain what this was all about and also how this ties into your findings and the Republican presidential hopeful?
Sure. Basically, in a nutshell, a company that is regulated by the FCC wanted a decision to be made by the Federal Communications Commission, and John McCain wrote letters to the commissioners of this regulatory agency urging that they make a decision. First broken, I believe, by the Boston Globe. This story is really interesting, mostly, I think, because of the deja vu quality. It gives the impression and the aura of the Keating Five scandal all over again for the last survivor in American politics of that big scandal back in the early part of the decade. And so the issue is that, that a member happens to be the Senate Commerce Committee chairman and has the most important jurisdictional role in Washington over the entire telecommunications industry, is sending a letter on behalf of a single entity, a company, Paxton is the name of the company, to the regulator. This is obviously completely inappropriate. And even the sending of the letter, which McCain claims he just sent a letter and he didn't really tell them what to decide, just to please decide it, that is, for someone who went through the Keating Five mess and almost lost his career, you would think he would have enough sense not to do something, frankly, that stupid. It looks all the worse because he traveled on the company's corporate jet and there are contributions to his campaigns. And McCain, of course, is being hoisted on his own petard of sorts as a campaign finance and politics reformer, because here is, this reformer who has been caught doing what everyone else does, which, of course, anyone who thinks for about 3 seconds knows he has to do that to raise millions of dollars. You have to make these accommodations. Of course, you have done things like this over the years, and so is every other member running. But so anyway, it's a delicious snippet and window, really, into how Washington works. And that one is bite-sized because there's a letter, and it's very timely, and it's right around the time of the debates in New Hampshire, and it's very concrete, and I'm really glad that it is being covered, because if that's how the public learns and understands and gleans more information about all these candidates is through episodic things like this, I think it's constructive for democracy.
It's interesting. It's also something that we can sort of get a picture of. You have on December 9th the Paxson company jet ferrying McCain to a Florida fundraiser that was held aboard a yacht in West Palm Beach. The next day, McCain sends his letter to the FCC in his capacity as chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, urging a speedy vote on Paxson's proposed purchase of a Pittsburgh TV station. As I watched him defend himself last night, he said, "This is about U.S. taxpayers having
having a right to speedy decisions, decisions that it's taken the FCC 2 years to make.
Right. You know, that we all know that regulators do things whatever way they want, and every agency has its own tempo and momentum. But the bottom line is you don't send a letter like that, especially if you're running for president, trying to reform politics, and especially if you almost lost your entire lunch and career over a scandal where you tried to lean on a regulator. If there's anyone that should be sensitive to appearances on something like this, it should be John McCain. And so
it's also caused him to cancel a fundraiser he was going to have this Saturday night.
Yeah, that's somewhat delicious. It's true. So anyway, now the question is what happens from here with McCain and the issue. But I think it is illustrative of how the process works. And, you know, McCain has all kinds of other problems. The idea that this is unfair, he's getting too much scrutiny because of his reform positions is a little bit empty because he is in up to his ears with all kinds of interests, including telecom interests. The first largest patron for him is U.S. West. They have a virtual monopoly on local telephone service in 14 states. They've given him over $100,000. He introduced the Internet Regulatory Regulatory Freedom Act, which, among other things, will give U.S. West the ability to transmit the Internet. Same day he introduces the bill, the CEO of U.S. West euphorically proclaims that his company will make millions of dollars from the bill. And, you know, you get the picture. His wife is a vice president of the largest Anheuser-Busch beer distributorship in the U.S. And so beer interests and the Hensley Company is the name of it, and Phoenix is his second patron. But he has done things for all kinds of donors, and we lay this out in fairly elaborate detail in our chapter in the Buying the President 2000 about McCain. He's tied to mining interests, banking interests. There's a company called Dell Webb where he put a hold on a Senate bill to help them keep a land deal. They were working with the federal government. I mean, he has done favors for donors over the years, and he has received money to his campaigns, and that is how Washington works, and I know that many Americans in their gut recognize this, but rarely is it documented, frankly, and you have this dichotomy between the reality and what these people say, which makes everyone, as the singer Sting says, look at politicians like game show hosts. I mean, we don't look at them as being, frankly, very truthful.
Well, Chuck Lewis, I want to thank you for being with us. And we haven't gotten through the list, even halfway, of the even major Republican and Democratic candidates. And so we will continue with you tomorrow, starting off by looking at George Bush, this after tonight's Republican debate in New Hampshire. Charles Lewis is the founder of the Center for Public Integrity. The book that they have just put out is The Selling of the President. And we're going to talk more about money in politics throughout the campaign and focus specifically tomorrow on the findings of this book. You can also go to the website to find the outlines of those findings at www.publicintegrity.org. That's www.publicintegrity.org. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a look at Agent Orange in Vietnam and here at home. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt Jr., who was commander of U.S. naval operations during part of the Vietnam War, died early on Sunday at the age of 79. During the Vietnam War, he ordered much of the spraying of Agent Orange along Vietnamese waterways. In later years, Zumwalt blamed the defoliant, which contained the toxic chemical dioxin, for the death from cancer of his own son, Elmo Zumwalt III. The elder Zumwalt said he did not regret ordering the use of Agent Orange because it reduced casualties, he said, by making it difficult for the enemy to hide and find food. More recently, he has supported efforts to add a plaque to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington honoring veterans who died from ailments related to Agent Orange. On a 1994 visit to Vietnam after his retirement from the Navy, Zumwalt proposed joint research on Agent Orange's effects. His visit made him the most senior wartime U.S. officer to visit Vietnam since the end of the war. It has been almost 25 years since the war's end. The U.S. military dumped a total of more than 11 million tons of the defoliant Agent Orange on Vietnam in the course of that war, so named because it was shipped to Vietnam in 55-gallon drums marked with an orange stripe. Thousands of American servicemen were contaminated by the dioxin in Agent Orange after remaining in the area for a year. But what's happened to the millions of Vietnamese who remain there and who have been exposed to Vietnam over the last quarter of a century? We're joined right now by Bob Dreyfus, who recently spent time in Vietnam looking at the effects of Agent Orange and wrote a cover story for this month's issue of Mother Jones called Apocalypse Still. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob Dreyfus.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can you talk about what you found in Vietnam?
Well, it's actually been almost 30 years since the United States used Agent Orange because in 1970, the United States stopped using the chemical after the effects on humans began to become known. Many of the both civilians and soldiers who were living in Vietnam at the time lived and worked and breathed in the residue of this chemical, and in some cases during the actual spraying. In contrast to American soldiers who served in Vietnam, who, after all, drank bottled water and ate processed foods and were there for only a brief time, perhaps a year or so, the Vietnamese, you know, walked barefoot and drank the water and lived there continuously and in much, much larger numbers. Millions or perhaps tens of millions of Vietnamese were affected by this. What's become known in Vietnam since all of this took place is that there were a large number of illnesses, including cancers, at a much higher rates among people who were living or fighting in exposed areas. And in the second generation, beginning in the mid-1970s and continuing even today, children born with birth defects, severe spinal deformities, and other serious, if not crippling, birth defects born over the last 25 years, obviously many of them now adult-age children, others younger, and recent research has shown that the chemical, although much of it has been washed out of the land, still in some areas exists in the ground, in the water, in the food chain, so that it's still entering human life and causing effects from illnesses to birth defects even today. Mothers, through their milk, pass it on to their children. It's in the fish and the fowl that people eat. And where there's some activity, let's say construction, that might stir up this chemical, which persists, that is the dioxin part of Agent Orange, persists for quite a while. What happens then is it gets back into the system and again causes these kinds of effects. The amazing thing about it is that Vietnam, being first of all preoccupied with reconstruction over the last 25 years, and even in some cases with new wars, and then second, being very poor, hasn't been able to spend the probably tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that it would take to study where this chemical still exists. It's very, very expensive to do the testing. And so in Hanoi, officials don't even know where to begin. I mean, they have some rough idea because they know where the chemical was sprayed in general, and they know where former military American military bases were, which were centers of the heaviest use and also some dumping and spills of the chemical. But in terms of being able to test the soil and the water, each test costs about $600 to $1,000. And so to do widespread testing would be prohibitively expensive for them.
You mentioned in your piece that a State Department source told you that there's real concern for going down the road of research around Agent Orange because that leads to liability questions.
Well, the State Department official in Hanoi tried to actually talk me out of doing the story. They and then when that obviously didn't work, then they pretty much refused to cooperate with the story. They would like it all to go away. They're afraid that Vietnam could come to them, probably not in a legal sense, but as part of the ongoing talks between the two countries, and start perhaps more forcefully than they've done so far, ask for humanitarian or other assistance, not just for research, but to take care of the people affected by it. There are large numbers of people who get very little, if any, compensation in Vietnam for their injuries.
Well, Bob Dreyfus, we're also joined by Stephen Malloy, editor of JunkScience.com, with the Cato Institute. You've been on the major media talking about dioxin not being proven to be harmful to human beings.
Right. The United States has spent probably more than $1 billion researching dioxin, which is the contaminant of concern in Agent Orange. We spent that money over the last 25 years. There's still no agreement that Agent Orange or that dioxin has caused any health effects in humans other than severe acne in people who are very highly exposed. We've we just haven't seen any effects. And if you look at the studies of Agent Orange on U.S. servicemen, none of those studies show any health effects, even among the most highly exposed servicemen. And some of these servicemen would actually drink the Agent Orange as a rite of passage before flying their missions. We know people have been very highly exposed to Agent Orange and very highly exposed to dioxin. We don't see the health effects that are claimed. The birth defects that are occurring in Vietnam, for example, the spina bifida. Spina bifida has many causes. One of them is lack of folic acid, which is a B vitamin. It's quite conceivable that the birth defects of Vietnam are due to a poor diet or, you know, other causes, but there's no evidence linking them to Agent Orange.
We're also joined on the phone from Texas by Dr. Arnold Schechter, professor of environmental sciences at the University of Texas School of Public Health. He's the person who you might see in pictures of the late Admiral Zumwalt. He arranged his trip to Vietnam. What are your thoughts on JunkScience.com and Stephen Malloy's comments that Agent Orange has no effect?
Well, let me help Mr. Malloy to understand the field better. In 1997, the World Health Organization declared that the dioxin in Agent Orange was a definite human carcinogen, and in Volume 69, an expert committee from the United States, chaired by Dr. George Lucier of NIH, with Dr. Linda Birnbaum of EPA and other experts present,
noted the endocrine disruption that is caused by dioxin in humans, the reproductive and developmental effects, and most recently, of course, the Institute of Medicine in its of the National Academy of Sciences in its Veterans in Agent Orange study notes those human health conditions for which there is a statistical association found between dioxin exposure in the peer-reviewed published literature, much of which is reviewed in my book, Dioxins in Health, by experts. We now know from the National Institute on Occupational Safety and Health two things, that dioxins have caused cancer mortality, cancer deaths in American workers exposed to dioxin. In the article published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Marilyn Fingerhut and other NIOSH authors. And more recently, NIOSH has shown that chemical workers exposed to dioxin are at higher risk of developing adult-onset diabetes. The same finding has been noted in the American ranch hand study by the U.S. Air Force of the higher dioxin blood levels have been, even in the general population levels, not just the ranch handers who sprayed it, and some of whom do have elevated dioxin, there is elevated risk for dioxin. That was just published by authors from the National Institute of Health and the U.S. Air Force recently. In addition, I would disagree with the recent comments of the gentleman from the junkscience.com that once dioxins go into the fat, they stay there. That is not the case. They are in equilibrium with blood and other organs of the human body. We have found, for example, blood levels of dioxin elevated for 35 years after exposure in some workers. The studies from the United States and Holland have demonstrated that children born to women in the general population, but with the higher level of these toxic persistent synthetic chemicals, the children will have certain deficits, hormone alterations, weight changes, lower IQ, and other problems. The statement that was also made recently on CNN television that Americans have higher levels of dioxin exposure than Vietnamese is not correct. In our studies and the peer-reviewed literature, which is reviewed by the Institute of Medicine, the World Health Organization, EPA, ATSDR, CDC, and other American and world scientific bodies at the highest level, the findings show that dioxins are causing in humans similar response to other mammals, and the recent NIH findings are that human tissue is about as sensitive as rat or mouse tissue to dioxins when it comes to enzyme induction and other effects that show sensitivity to dioxins.
Dr. Schechter and Steve Malloy, because we've come to the end of the program, I want to ask if you might be able to join us for a second part of this discussion tomorrow on Democracy Now! I think it's very important to look at these issues, and I'm sure that Steve Malloy has responses. Would you both be available?
Of course.
Sure.
Great. So that will be part two of our debate tomorrow, as well as part two of Charles Lewis looking at the money in politics following the Republican debate tonight, as we've looked at the Democrats today. Dr. Schechter at the University of Texas School of Public Health, Stephen Malloy, editor of JunkScience.com, and Bob Dreyfus, who wrote the cover piece for Mother Jones magazine, Agent Orange, 25 years after the fall of Saigon, the people of Vietnam continue to pay the price for America's chemical warfare. And that does it for the program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Matthew Finch is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!